This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this hour of the show, the second hour of the program, we'll be talking a bit about the state of the American military. And our guest for the program is David Siegel. He is a sociologist. He's also director of the Center for Research on Military Organization at the University of Maryland and has done a lot of writing and research on issues related to the military. And let me just mention the titles of a few of his books that'll give you some sense of the kinds of things he's interested in. The most recent is a book titled The Postmodern Military, published by Oxford University Press in 2000. He's also written the books Peacekeepers and Their Wives, another titled Recruiting for Uncle Sam, Citizenship and Military Manpower Policy, and Life in the Rank and File, Enlisted Men and Women in the Armed Forces of the United States, Australia, Canada, and the UK. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. Again, we just ask people to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different calls as possible. But folks are welcome to call with questions and comments, certainly. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. And that's the local number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you want to join the conversation, you certainly may do that. Professor Siegel, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You know, for some time now, we've been reading stories about how the military is having a difficult time retaining and attracting people to serve and meeting its recruiting goals. So we hear stories about, for example, people who are in the military being told that they are going to have to stay longer. The military has done things like increased signing bonuses. They have raised the maximum age at which you can enlist, which I think is now 42, is
42.
It? 42. And perhaps most controversial of all of that is they have lowered their standards. They're taking people now that in the past they would not have taken. And I think some people have some questions about, you know, is that going to have an effect one way or another about the generally the quality of the military? If you're taking people whose academic performance is not what it was, if their background is not what it used to be, you know, is that going to be a problem or not? Why is it? And I don't know how complicated a question this is, but why is it that it seems that the military is having a very difficult time attracting people and also attracting enough really high caliber people?
Well, I think that the fundamental answer is that it is easier to recruit in peacetime than in wartime. Many of the appeals for recruiting, for example, educational incentives, and this is particularly relevant to the National Guard, assume that troops are going to be stationed in the continental United States and able to use their educational benefits. If they're being deployed, then the educational benefits are not as attractive.
Is this really a particularly new concern, or is this something that has now? Obviously, here we're in a time where we don't have a draft anymore, so there are some differences between times in the past. But is this in fact something that's really new, or is it always something that the military has dealt with?
Well, in a sense, it is something new because this is the first time we have fought a long, large war with the all-volunteer force. And, in fact, we're asking the all-volunteer force to do something that it was not designed to do, and therein is the problem. When President Nixon's commission on the all-volunteer force made its recommendations on ending conscription, they recommended that we go to a volunteer force with a standby draft, and in the course of their discussions suggested and indeed assumed that if we were to fight a long, large-scale war, we would go back to conscription. And as I recall, their definition of what a long, large-scale war was the deployment of over 100,000 personnel for a period of more than 6 months. And we've passed that threshold.
We're
basically asking the volunteer force to do something it wasn't designed to do.
Yeah, at some point, as people have pointed out, at some point we're going to get to the point here where the Iraq War has been going on as long as World War II went.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I just ask the question, do you think that there is any real possibility of the reinstitution of a draft?
I don't think either our national leadership or the American public have the stomach for military conscription in support of the current military operations. I think that there would have to be a perception that national security were indeed under significant threat. And I don't think that perception exists today, quite frankly, in the public or in the Congress.
So in what ways have recruiters and the military generally, have they tried to accommodate to the fact that it's getting more difficult? How have they changed their rules, or how have they changed what they're looking for or what they will accept?
Well, the first almost knee-jerk reaction on the part of the recruiting community and policymakers was to increase enlistment bonuses. But there's just so far you can go in using money as a motivator to send people to war. And I think that they've reached the limits of that. As you mentioned, they have, in a sense, lowered the standards, although not as much as one would expect. We had been recruiting above what had been the legal standards. And we've now essentially started recruiting closer to the legal standards. When we're talking about, for example, taking more non-high school graduates or more soldiers who score in the lowest acceptable mental category, you're really talking about percentages in the single digits. You're talking about changes at the margins. When you think about raising the recruiting age, there are a lot of people in their early 40s in the United States today who are in much better shape than a lot of people in their 20s. The military has, on the one hand, been complaining that among the youth population, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, almost three-quarters are not eligible to serve. On the other hand, you've got people in their 40s who have stayed in pretty good condition, and I think that what we've learned is that it doesn't make sense to use age as a surrogate for ability to do the job, just as a couple of decades ago we learned that it didn't make sense to use gender as a surrogate for measuring ability to do the job.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that gets at the question, if, for example, you decide you're going to take people who are more than 40, or if you decide that you're going to take people who have not completed high school, or if on some kind of objective standard you've used to set a line and now you're saying you're going to take people that are below that line, even if it's only a little bit below that line. Does all of that, how problematic is all of that? And does that, in fact, should we be concerned about the quality of people who are going into the military, or do we make too much of that?
No, I don't think we make too much of it. There are reasons for the standards that existed, and the reasons were that people who did not meet those standards were more likely not to make it through basic training, or if they got into the Army, not to be good soldiers. But you're talking about probabilistic processes. Some of them were good soldiers. When we said that a general education diploma was not the same thing as a high school diploma, for example, and virtually didn't take anybody who didn't have a high school diploma, I think it's important to recognize that there are different reasons why people don't graduate from high school and don't get get GEDs instead. In the case of, for example, a young man who happened to be the oldest sibling in a family where the father passed away and he had to drop out of high school to support his family, and therefore didn't get a high school diploma, is a very different case than somebody who was constantly in disciplinary problems or legal problems, problems with the law when he was in high school, and was thrown out and eventually got a GED. And I would guess that the fellow in the former situation is going to turn out to be a better soldier than the latter, although on paper neither of them have high school diplomas and both have GEDs.
Hmm. Something that I know that you have done research on goes to this question of motivation, about why it is that someone would volunteer to serve in the military. And particularly, I guess we'd ask the question, why is it someone would do that in peacetime, or why is it someone would do that in wartime? Why is it that young people, or maybe I shouldn't say young people, that anyone would make that decision? And, you know, how do you weigh the relative contributions of patriotism on the one hand, and on the other hand, the fact that you could look at it as a job, that it provides you with training, it provides you with education, and perhaps that also, again, varies depending upon what's going on at that time. Is there a war on or not?
That is a phenomenally complex question, and I've never spoken to a young soldier who had only one reason for joining. So in any individual case, you're going to have multiple reasons for coming into the military. A lot of them have to do with financial well-being. The military during peacetime is a pretty good job, particularly for people from segments of the population who have trouble getting employment to the civilian labor force. It's also a way of finding some adventure, doing something exciting. If you've grown up in a fairly quiet neighborhood and a fairly quiet family and want to get out and experience the world, it's one way to do it. For a lot of people, it's been a way of getting money to go on to college. And there has been, at least since World War II, a sense of latent patriotism among American youth that I think the recruiting community probably hasn't taken sufficient advantage of. We have not in the all-volunteer force period seen posters that say, join the military and serve your country. I guess now we're beginning to see them. But they've all been, it's a good place to start. You know, the Army wants to join you. The appeals have been more toward preparing people for civilian careers than for serving the military, although patriotism has clearly been something that's been expressed by recruits, at least for as long as I've been studying the all-volunteer force.
Something that's that is an interesting trend is that apparently the military is started to do some experimenting with hiring private firms, essentially, to do the job of the recruiter. That's not that we don't have the sort of traditional military recruiters that we had before, where people, they were uniformed military personnel who had that as their job. But they're also going outside of that and literally hiring private hunting firms to do that kind of job. And I wonder if you have had the opportunity or anybody has looked at how it is that those two entities, that is the traditional military recruiter and the private firm, how they do, and in fact whether one or the other seems to be more successful at finding people to go into the military.
Well, first of all, we're not the first country to have done that. Other countries, I remember years ago talking to somebody from the Admiralty over in England who was talking about the military, the Navy, the Royal Navy, hiring private employment firms to recruit sailors. And it's one reflection of a more general process of outsourcing that characterizes both American industry and the American military. I think there is a reasonable division of labor. To the extent that recruiters are spending time sitting at desks trying to make telephone contact with prospects and having, over time, relatively low success rates and getting increasingly frustrated, I think that it probably makes sense to take advantage of the fact that there's now a fairly large labor pool of unemployed telemarketers who are finding more problems in getting employment than what they used to do because more people don't want to be called. And they have experience in making telephone contact and in keeping people on the phone and talking to them. And if that part of the function is turned over to civilians, then the military recruiters themselves are probably in better shape to meet face-to-face with prospects after school hours instead of having been sitting behind a telephone, sitting behind a desk, sweating into their uniforms. They can look freshly pressed and present a more military image to a potential recruit as a result of not having spent all day on the telephone. So, yeah, I think there are ways in which civilians can be used. It's not only in the recruiting business that we're using more civilians. Increasingly, the military is working at defining what are core military functions that have to be performed by people in uniforms. And what can be turned on to civilians.
And that's something I think that's interesting. If you take a look at all of the kind of support services that's necessary to maintain an army, all the things that have to do with housing them and feeding them and providing them with health care and, you know, whatever else all that is that something that you think we're going to see, an area where you're going to see more outsourcing and more private businesses providing those kinds of services that previously, one or another, that was all part of the military?
That certainly has been the trend for the last several years, and it's certainly the priority of the current administration. So, yeah, I think we're going to see more of it.
Is that more cost effective?
Nobody has ever demonstrated that that's more cost-effective, although that is the major justification for outsourcing. That's something that the Government Accountability Office has looked at a couple of times and has found that they cannot demonstrate that there are cost savings to outsourcing or to civilianization.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Siegel. He's a sociologist, professor of sociology, and also director of the Center for Research on Military Organization at the University of Maryland. Questions are welcome here as we're talking about the state of the American military forces, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here standing by. We'll go first to Charleston, and that's our toll free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David. I have a bit of a view of the National Guard, per se, and its history, both in modern and ancient times. You know, the Roman Empire didn't fare very well whenever the German mercenaries came, you know, and became the Roman Legion. And the same applies today with the American National Guard, whom, if I'm interpreting the meaning of these things properly, that when you are paid to be a soldier, you are necessarily mercenary. That's what separates the draftee from the paid mercenary soldier whose only interest is his own, and they do what they have to do under certain conditions. And what is happening today with the National Guard being turned over and over again into Iraq and other places, and then all these horrendous crimes being committed by those folk. Well, I want to take you back again to, I'm an older man, but I remember as a child in the 1930s, whenever there were labor troubles, any sort of domestic unrest, the first people were the National Guard. And these folk had the nickname of daddy killers. A son with a rifle and the daddy on a picket line. And that sort of image has stuck with me all these years, and I have had learned nothing that is strong enough to change that. The thing that your guest just said about easier recruitment in hard economic times and the expendable lower working class who cannot finish school for a variety of reasons, and suddenly this market is opened up for the mercenary soldier. And that's my comment.
Well, okay. I don't, Professor Siegel, you want to comment on any of that?
Well, I suspect there are a lot of National Guard members and supporters out there who would bristle at the conceptualization of today's National Guard as mercenary. As a moonlighting kind of thing, as a second job, it's a lousy way to make money. The mission of the Guard has changed tremendously over the course of our history. For much of our history, the Guard and before it the militia was our primary mobilization base. And when we went to war, for example, in World War I and World War II, the first people who got sent were the National Guard because we did not maintain standing armies, and they were the only people who were available. Now, it's also the case that when there was domestic unrest, we also sent in the Guard for exactly the same reason. We did not have a standing army that the government could call on. We have massively transformed the nature of the Guard over the last quarter of a century or so. You may recall that back in Vietnam, the administration decided not to do what we had done historically, that is, decided not to send the National Guard to war. And indeed, service in the National Guard during the Vietnam War was a way of fulfilling the letter of the law with regard to military obligations and serving in the military without really running the risk of being sent to the war zone. Since then, we have increasingly integrated the Guard with the active components into a total force, and indeed now have a military that can't go to war without the Guard. Now, at the same time, the case that most people who have joined the Guard joined under the assumption that it was a strategic reserve, that it would not be sent to war unless there was a full national mobilization. And in the course of the current conflict in Iraq, we have transformed that function from a strategic reserve to an operational reserve. And people in the Guard know that they're going to go to war. And certainly people who have joined the Guard in the last couple of years know that they're not going to be sitting at home. But with the demise of the role of conscript in the American military, the National Guardsman is really our last vestige of the citizen soldier, who holds an iconic position in American society. I don't think that there are very many people in the Guard who actually do it for the money.
Well, you know, given as you say, that this change in the role of the Guard and the fact that now it has been, in a sense, folded into the regular military in a way that had not really been, well, I was going to say not before, but not in some time, maybe that's a better way to say it. How do people in the Guard and in the military feel about that, or do they have strong feelings about that one way or another?
From what I have seen, and I've talked to a number of people in the Guard, it has been influenced tremendously by when they came into the Guard and what their expectations were when they joined.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a kind of internal generation gap in the sense that people who have joined the Guard since we started deploying large numbers of Guardsmen to Iraq come in with the expectation that, yeah, they're going to go to war even if the nation doesn't declare a draft. Whereas people who were previously in the Guard served under the impression that they would not go to war unless there were a national mobilization and the deployment of the Guard were followed by conscription.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the call. Let's talk with somebody else. We'll go to Champagne next, line one. Hello.
Yeah, my question was, too, about mercenaries, but I wasn't going to place the Guard there. First, your outsourcing recruiters, that's a mercenary function. Truck drivers in Iraq, interrogators in Iraq, those are mercenary functions and I think a very corrupting influence. That was one comment I had. And then the other question I have is, do you think conscription is dead? And if the continued recruiting problems persist, do you think that conscription will be attempted, and do you think it could survive?
I don't think conscription is completely dead in the United States, in that I do believe that if there were a perception that there were a pressing threat to our national security, the American people would tolerate it. I don't think that perception is there now. And I don't think that it would be politically feasible for the administration to try to institute conscription to support the war in Iraq.
Right. And what about mercenaries in the military that are not actually in the military, but they are mercenaries fulfilling military functions?
I'm still not all that comfortable with the concept of mercenaries. You know, historically, we've always had civilians supporting military operations, you know, going back to the Revolution.
But not going back to, World War II, maybe on American soil, but the truck drivers and the interrogators and...
Right, they were all uniformed personnel.
Right.
For example, if you went to an American armored cav base in Vietnam, you were going to find civilian contractors maintaining the helicopters.
Too. And I believe it's probably a corrosive force.
It may well be. In fact, it's something we're just beginning to do research on to determine how the people in uniform respond to sharing their workplace with civilians who are serving under very different conditions than they are.
Okay.
And it's something we're just scratching the surface of. I think it is an important question. I think right now it's an empirical question, and we don't have the answer yet.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, I think this is a very interesting area and perhaps made more interesting or more problematic by, in some people's minds at least, this highly charged word, mercenary,
mm-hmm.
and the sort of fuzzy definition of what a mercenary is. And I think traditionally, as you say, a mercenary means someone who is paid to fight, but is not in the regular army, or at least not in the regular army of that country. So by that definition, I'm not exactly sure that, say, if you hire a firm to provide meals to the soldiers, the cooks aren't mercenaries, but if you hire people and you give them guns and they go out and they engage the enemy, well, they may be mercenaries, but then again, they may not, depending on what it is they're actually hired to do. The fact that you give somebody a gun and you can say, and you say to them, if somebody shoots at you, you can shoot back. Well, I'm not sure that necessarily makes that person a mercenary. I guess I'm in my own mind, I'm a little bit confused about the issue, essentially the issue of private contractors contracting out military functions, and particularly when it comes to shooting, what exactly that means, and how people who are in the regular military feel about the fact that there are people who are employed to do military tasks, who carry guns, who engage the enemy, who, as you say, operate under different rules, and in fact may be paid significantly more for doing what maybe looks like the same job.
You're right. This is a very, very fuzzy area. It would have been less fuzzy under old conditions of conventional warfare, where, for example, you had contractors running kitchens and dining facilities, mess halls, well behind the forward edge of the battle area. So they weren't near where the action is. The fact is that in Iraq today, once you put your boots on the ground and step out of the airport, you're in a combat zone, whether you're a civilian or a military person. And you're likely to get shot at, and smart people will, if they have to, defend themselves. And while it is the case that most contract personnel are not issued arms, it is also the case that in a place like Iraq, there are always arms available. And if they happen to be with a unit that comes under fire, they can, in fact, lift up a rifle and shoot it. So what is military and what is civilian, or what is combat and what is not combat, becomes much fuzzier. The same distinction holds within the military as well. Prior to Iraq in the Army, we used to draw what we thought were firm distinctions between combat specialties, combat support specialties, and combat service support specialties, with the pointy end of the spear, the combat specialties, being your tankers and your infantrymen, combat engineers, air defense, forward deployed air defense artillery. And people like MPs and cooks were further back. That's not the case anymore. The MPs, the cooks, the truck drivers, they're on the highways, and the highways are the battle zones. So now, basically, everybody who's in the military in the combat zone is a warrior. That definition does spill over onto the civilian contractors who are not subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's something that we have to, as a nation, think long and hard about. Yeah.
And again, so then if you ask the question, how do people who are in the regular military or the National Guard, you know, those people who are clearly uniform military personnel covered by the Uniform Code of Military Justice, they work ultimately for the Pentagon, I suppose some of these other people might also actually ultimately work for the Pentagon. But if you ask how those people, those regular soldiers, feel about these other people, these security contractors who are armed, who do have quasi-military missions, who may engage the enemy, how it is that the regular military feel about these people, it sounds as if you're saying, well, we really don't know that yet.
That's something we have just started doing research on. And we've actually done a few case studies where there are military and civilians sharing workspaces in a variety of places, including on a Navy ship and in an overseas deployed combat aviation unit. And my sense from the data, on the one hand, is that the more contact the military personnel have with the civilians, the more highly they think of them. And their view is that the civilians are performing a function that needs to be performed, and in some cases, assuring that the military personnel won't have to do it. So, for example, in the Navy ship that we studied, civilians, in this case not contractors, but civilian employees of the Navy, were doing a lot of the tasks that Navy personnel don't like doing, like chipping paint and repainting and working in the galleys and sweeping the decks. And in a sense, if that ship found itself under fire, if it was in combat, the civilians and the military personnel would literally be in the same boat. That is, whether the civilians joined up to be in combat, if that ship was in combat, the civilians would be in combat.
Mm-hmm.
And the military personnel understood that. And they all agreed that the civilians shared responsibility for the safety of the ship. So, for example, firefighting on the ship. You know, a fire on a Navy ship is one of the worst things that can happen. And at a lot of the fire stations, the chief of the fire station was one of the civilian employees. So there, and And as I said, the more contact the military personnel had with the civilians, the more highly they thought of them. Now, interestingly, the one big difference between the military personnel and the civilians that we interviewed, the one big difference that came out, was their desire to stay in the jobs that they were in. And the military personnel were much less likely to see themselves as trying to extend themselves in their current job for a long time than the civilians.
Let's talk to some other folks. We have some other callers here standing by. Someone in Urbana next, line one. Hello.
Hi. Two observations. One has to do with women in the military. Before the Afghan-Iraq wars, we had quite a string of letters to the editor back and forth about the pros and cons of women in the military. And those stopped once we got involved in these conflicts. And you've touched on the fact that I think you said something about the fact that if we did not have women in the military, we'd be in deep trouble in terms of being able to come anywhere close to meeting our needs. So that's one observation. And I don't know whether the long-term attitudes have changed or what's going on, but whether that's a short-term thing. But my other comment is about the effect of the use of the National Guard on our perception of George Bush, the current president. You know, people who are in their 50s and 60s, late 50s maybe, and 60s, remember what it was like when the Vietnam draft was going on and how the rules kept changing and life was really, really difficult to figure out in terms of plans. But because we're using the National Guard so much, and George Bush essentially got out of going to Vietnam by working his way, by getting a transfer into the National Guard and then not being there very much, I think a lot of people have forget that that's what he did and that the National Guard didn't play the same role in Vietnam that it does now, because a lot of people weren't conscious, we're too young to understand what was going on.
Those of us who are in our 50s or 60s or older do remember that.
Yes, but the younger people wouldn't know. They,
right.
They're not aware of they don't have the actual experience to stick in their mind with regard to that. So that's just two comments I wanted to share. Thanks.
All right. Well, you can comment on that any way you like.
Well, with regard to women in the military, you're right. There was much more national discussion of the role of women in the military prior to Operation Iraqi Freedom. And I think it had to do in part with there being segments of the population who raised issues about whether women could do the job. And one of the things that women have demonstrated in Iraq, not for the first time, was that they can do the job. And indeed, some of the most talented people we have in the military today are women. And it is the case that had we not significantly increased our recruitment of women in the all-volunteer force, we would have failed from the very beginning to meet our end strength goals and maintain the size force that we wanted. But you're right. I think that we have stopped debating about whether women can serve, and I think that's a healthy thing. We no longer regard the military as necessarily a gendered role in society, and we no longer, to the same extent, use gender as a screen for deciding who can serve, although there are still specialties that women are excluded from. But most jobs in the military are now open to women, and they're performing well. With regard to the changing role of the National Guard, particularly since Vietnam, you're right in your observation. I think it's important to point out that George Bush was not alone among our national leaders in our current national leaders, in using the National Guard to avoid going to war. And indeed, that was very common in his generation. And it was socially acceptable. We said you have an obligation to share in the common defense. If you serve in the Guard, you share in the common defense. We're not sending the Guard to Vietnam. And it was not the decision of the Guard not to go to Vietnam. It was the decision of our civilian leadership.
I'm interested in the caller raises the issue of the situation for women in the military, and what, from time to time, one does read stories about women who say that they experience really, really severe sexual harassment, and you makes one wonder about the military. Is it indeed welcoming of women? Is that a good place for them to be? Is it a good job? What are conditions like? Has anybody really looked at that in a large kind of a way?
There has been a lot of analysis of that. And the fact is that historically, the culture of the military has been a masculine culture, and that does not go away overnight. So that there are still more than pockets of resistance to the integration of women, but now this year we're celebrating 30 years of women at the federal military academies. Starting tonight, there's a conference at the Naval Academy on 30 years of women at Annapolis, those women, the class of 1980, remember when James Webb, who served as Secretary of the Navy, said that women can't fight, and that the Naval Academy has now become, I think his phrase was, a bastion for horny women. We don't have that view anymore. But it is also the case that in dealing with the military, as is the case in dealing with colleges and universities, you're dealing with a relatively young population of men and women who are experiencing things hormonally that they're not quite in control of or understand. And for universities as well as the military, issues of sexual harassment are problematic, in part because of the age group that they're dealing with.
We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is sociologist David Siegel. He's director of the Center for Research on Military Organization at the University of Maryland. And we're talking some about the state of America's military today. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Champaign, and it's line 2. Hello.
Hi. I was a civilian contractor in Vietnam. And I work directly with soldiers doing exactly the same job. I'm interested in how the literature develops on the relationship between civilians and soldiers. And I'd like to offer a hypothesis. That is that the military under some circumstances, or these mixed groups under some circumstances, reflects American society in that it's a meritocracy. My exact experience was small group of electronics technicians, probably a dozen civilians, a dozen soldiers, E4s and 5s, in Da Nang, fixing two-way radios. And we worked out of several vans that were connected together. These were air-conditioned vans because all the electronic equipment, of course, was had to be kept somewhat cool to work.
Right, the air conditioning is for the machines, not the people.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. We did exactly the same work. That is, we worked on various kinds of two-way radios. Now, the interesting thing is that some of those radios were rather complex, and some were quite simple to repair, and some were unrepairable and got sent back to the depot in the U.S. But of the ones that could be repaired, some of the soldiers and some of the civilians repaired the easy-to-repair ones, and some did other models that were harder to repair. My impression was that the technicians who were more skilled did the harder to repair radios and were called in on the harder problems. I know that one of the technicians had a college degree, and I mean one of the soldiers had a college degree and was almost immediately assigned a paperwork role in that repair unit. Another thing that's kind of interesting about it, to anecdotally confirm your suspicion that people with whom the soldiers are unfamiliar are less likely to be accepted. There was in that group one very highly paid engineer, a vendor company, who was there to help soldiers really repair these radios. This was not in the same group of people that were the dozen soldiers, dozen technicians. This guy really didn't deal with much except the few soldiers and technicians, very few, that dealt with the more complex radios. And he was not well regarded by anybody. And I assumed that it was because of his personality, but I readily accept that it was his lack of contact and lack of shared living space and so on that made him less respected, shall I say, by especially the soldiers in the group. So I'll pass that on. I just wanted to make a hypothesis. Again, it's an empirical question that that when groups are evenly mixed, soldiers and civilians of roughly the same ability, they get along beautifully and they organize themselves as a meritocracy with whoever is most capable doing the most difficult work. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thanks. Yeah.
All right. Professor Siegel, do you have some comments?
Yeah, I think that you make a very, very good point that, you know, basically cohesion in these work groups is not rooted so much in who wears uniform and who doesn't, as it is in what people's evaluations are of how the people they're working with contribute to their common tasks. And if they see everybody in the group helping to achieve the mission, then they're going to get along fine. And I think that the one case that you're referring to where the person did not live and really operate in the same social world as the others and was not as readily accepted, I think that's part of the reason. To tie together two themes that we've touched on in the discussion so far, I'd like to highlight the fact that, yes, we did deploy civilian contractors in support of the war in Vietnam at a time that we were not deploying the National Guard, and that's kind of interesting. We had people in uniform we were not sending to war, and we had people outside the military who we were.
Other questions? 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Now, right at the moment when the military is stretched, it seemingly stretched to capacity by war fighting, people, I think, have gotten away from some of the kind of questions that were being asked at the end of the Cold War, the questions about, well, what should now the role of the military be? And at that time, people were talking about new kinds of roles dealing with things like natural disaster. Of course, the military has been involved in peacekeeping. Now, recently, we do have the issues now since 9/11 of homeland security. So at least there was a time when people were talking a lot about non-traditional roles for the military and what, you know, now that the major threat that we had prepared for so long that was not there anymore, now what's the purpose of having the military? You know, now that we're in Iraq, I'm not sure people are asking that question so much anymore, but it seems that, you know, no doubt we may get back to that question. And I guess I'm curious about what the feeling was and maybe still had been about non-traditional, non-war-fighting role for the military and whether that was appropriate, whether that was something we needed to think about, particularly in the post-Cold War period.
Well, the answer that I got most commonly from military personnel when I asked them that, the career military personnel, military professionals, was the military is here to do what the country asks it to do. That is, we're not simply war fighters. We're here to act as an agent of the civilian authorities. Now, during most of the Cold War period, the United States did not get deeply involved in UN peacekeeping, although there was a lot of peacekeeping going on starting with the end of World War II. We didn't really get deeply involved in it until after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, in part because there was an assumption of being an objective third party for peacekeepers, disinterested, honest broker. And as long as there was a bipolar organization of power differentials in the world, the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact against the United States and NATO, there was a sense that neither the Soviet Union nor the United States could be an honest broker. After the end of the Cold War in Europe, and by the way, I don't think the Cold War is over on the Pacific Rim yet, but at least the end of Cold War in Europe, saw the United States getting more involved in multinational peacekeeping, initially with active duty troops, but over time that mission has increasingly been turned over to the National Guard. For example, in 1995, we used reserve component personnel in the Sinai peacekeeping operation, the multinational force and observers in the Sinai, in support of the Camp David Accords, for the first time. That mission has now been pretty much completely turned over to the National Guard. Historically, the Guard has been called up before active duty forces have been called up in the event of natural disasters. One of the problems we faced with Hurricane Katrina was that a good deal of the Guard, and more importantly, most of the heavy equipment of the National Guard in the Gulf region, was sitting over in Iraq, so that a lot of the Louisiana Guard was back in Louisiana. Some of it was still deployed, but most importantly, most of their radios and most of their trucks were sitting in Iraq, and those were elements of infrastructure that were assumed to be available in the case of disasters. So these are issues that I think we have to continue to talk through.
Mm-hmm. Let me raise a different question. There have been recently some very high-profile instances of gross misconduct on the part of troops in Iraq involving things like rape and murder of civilians. Now, I'm sure that if you go to the people in the Pentagon, you go to the people in the military, they would say that that's an aberration. They would say that most of the military people who are there do their jobs well, and they're dedicated good people, and they're just not doing stuff like that. Having said that, is there any evidence that the rate of misconduct by people in uniform is any more than it might have ever been?
I don't believe so, quite frankly. I think the basic assertion of the Defense Department is true. That is, that most people in the military are behaving the way they should and doing what they're supposed to do. You get occasional cases of really unacceptable behavior. But I think that that has always been the case in wartime. One of the things we kind of forget is that the veneer of civilization is very, very thin. And battlefield situations, wartime situations, are among the major situations when that veneer is likely to crack and people are, even good people, are likely to do bad things. I think that the fact is that over time, what goes on the battlefield has become more and more open to public observation, in part through the presence of the press, and is more likely to be identified.
Hmm. We'll see if we can get maybe one more caller in here at the time that remains. We have about two, 3 minutes. Someone who is here on our line number one. Let's go there. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to point this out, that you know, the relationship with the mercenary or whatever, the hired contractors, the Vietnam era Brown and Root, which wasn't owned by Halliburton at the time, the nickname for it by GIs was Burn and Loot. So it kind of conveys a little bit about how they felt about the Brown and Root at that time, it seems to me. It actually was Cheney in the Defense Department under Bush 1 that wrote the document that allowed for so much stuff to be contracted out, if I recall correctly, and then Halliburton turned around and bought Brown and Root. So I think it's really a hypocrisy of great dimension as far as sort of another way to expand the military-industrial complex into the other support aspects of it. I guess in a volunteer army, you also want to say you don't have to clean the spuds like they did in Vietnam, but then that was always KP, right? And that was a good way of punishing people. At least that's the truism. I don't know if that's really true. I don't think there's a whole lot of time left. But the other thing about the whole mercenary thing is that it's just I think there's more of a story there. There's one journalist, Jeremy Scahill, who's writing for The Nation, has an article called "Mercenary Jackpot," where he's talking about how much money is going this way. I don't actually think that the Congress is tracking how much is going in mercenary. I was shocked to read that one of these headhunters for mercenaries hired 1,200 Peruvians to go over and guard the green zone in the last month and a half or so. So, there's also the argument that some of these people are hired under one pretense, and then they're actually sent out on something very close to search and destroy.
Well, I'm going to jump in here because we're really short on time. I don't know, Professor Siegel, you want to comment on some of the things the caller said?
Well, I would certainly agree that there has not been sufficient oversight either by the Congress or indeed by the Defense Department of what activities are going on under these contracts. But I would point out that historically, the American military has depended on civilians for all sorts of functions, including medical functions. There was a long period of our history when we didn't really have a medical corps. Army divisions and indeed generals hired civilian surgeons to travel with their units to take care of their troops. And I'd be very, very slow to be willing to call those physicians and surgeons mercenaries.
We're going to have to close it out here. We've come to the end of the time. I want to say thanks to the people who called. I also want to thank our guest, David Siegel. He is professor of sociology and also director of the Center for Research on Military Organization at the University of Maryland. Professor Siegel, thank you very much for talking.
You're quite welcome.